You are listening to episode 15 of Crosshairs Radio. On today's show, we have Adam Meyerson. Adam is a well-known cycling personality in the U.S. He races cyclocross, also races criteriums on the road, and is the owner of Cycle Smart, a coaching company. We have a great conversation, wide-ranging topics from things going on in Europe, things going on to the U.S., to Adam's upbringing and what he contributed to the state of U.S. cyclocross. Hour, 15 minutes, all gold, all worth listening to. Really no sponsor for this show again, but what I would ask all of you to do is, if you like this podcast, to listen to my other podcast that deals with music. And I do it with a couple cycling buddies. And we talk about bands, we talk about shows we've gone to, what we've been listening to, and it's a good time. You might learn about some new tunes, some new bands, and enrich your life that way. Good for drives, good to be popping it in while you're going to the races or even sitting on your trainer. That is called Kids Don't Follow, or KDF Podcast. It's available on iTunes. Also, you can find it, just go to the Twitter feed, which is at KDF Podcast. So, go listen to that. Also, rate, review, subscribe to Crosshairs Radio on iTunes, and listen to Adam Meyerson. Go.
Currently, I'm in Athens, Georgia. I came down and did the North Carolina Grand Prix UCI races last weekend, and this has been a standard trip for me since they moved nationals to January. You know, we realized that you sort of needed a training camp. You know, you needed a block of training, you know, after the early December races if you were going to peak for a race that was, you know, second weekend of January. And so the North Carolina races moved to December, and that was a good anchor for us to just, for a lot of the New Englanders, to drive down, race North Carolina, and then stay down here for a week. And so the first year I was debating, like, just flying to Tucson for a week and then going home from there. And that's what Al and Jeremy did that year. And I opted to just stay here in Athens. And so then the next year everybody came to Athens. So I don't know if this is my third or fourth year of doing this trip. I've actually forgotten how many years I've done it. And Athens is I'm here regularly. You know, I'm here for Athens Twilight and for Speed Week. I spent a month here in April. This is typically my April road season base. So sure. To get to come here for a week or 10 days in December every year and do a camp is really great. So, yeah, I'm here until I fly home on Monday.
So what does that look like? What does a cyclocross, because a lot of, you know, people who are listening to this, seasons have pretty much ended. You know, some will be going to nationals, but most of the local series have finished up and people are done for the year. So what does a cyclocross camp look like in December? What are you guys doing?
Sure. Well, I'm going to be deliberately vague in my answer because this is the week that we do a lot of what I consider to be very proprietary workouts, things that we've developed ourselves that are very specific for, you know, whatever we're getting ready for, you know, whatever nationals course we're getting ready for, but also incorporate some stuff that we've learned from the trips to Europe and even things that we've learned from Jeremy. That we're a little bit protective of, and are things that we try to keep within Cycle Smart to a degree. But generally speaking, we're definitely looking for some volume. You know, the rides are longer because it's one of the only chances that we have after a season of like racing every weekend, you know, resting for 2 days, maybe doing a midweek workout to hold your form, you know, resting again and then opening up for the weekend. That race and recover period just goes on all season long, and you lose fitness as the year goes on from that. The bottom kind of comes out on it. And so you have to take a weekend off to really do the training that you want to do. And so volume is one of the things that comes back in, because it might make you a little bit slow, you know, the week that you do it. But once you recover from it and back off, that's one of the ways that, you know, you get the peak that we're really looking for. And that's what this week or 10-day block is really oriented around. It's oriented around a really big peak for nationals, and for the riders who are planning on going to Worlds from there, it lays the foundation for that form that they'll need to keep that nationals form going. So first and foremost, the rides are long. They're at least 3 hours. Sometimes I'll do as much as 6 hours. I don't think we're going to quite do that this year. We do a mix of, there's a number of us here, and so the workouts change based on each person and what they're doing. For me specifically, I'm doing a mix of, the block I'm doing basically consists of some 1 minute intervals, some 5 minute intervals, some 20 minute intervals, some hour long sessions. There's some motor pacing. There's some intervals that involve riding and running, you know, within the interval itself. We'll do a big group ride, the Winter Bike League WBL group ride that's here on Saturdays, and that's a 4 hour group ride. So that's how we'll get a lot of our sort of higher intensity endurance, you know, a little harder than you'd do if you were just riding around. It's almost like a long motor pacing session. And we'll do some riding in the woods. You know, we'll do some endurance rides where, you know, we ride on the road as a group to the woods and just go shred some mountain bike trails on our cross bikes for a couple hours and work on skills that way. So nothing, you know, there's no secrets in that one, right? Like, right. Those are just, yeah, we touch a little bit of everything, and how specific the workouts are depends on the person who's doing them and what it is exactly they're trying to work on.
So how's it going for you personally? I mean, knowing that, and we'll get into this a little more, but knowing that this is really it. This is your last team camp as a professional racer.
Yeah, it's going great. You know, I decided to rent my own house. I just rented this one bedroom cottage, and then the other guys were all staying in a house together. And so it's good for me because I'm also working every day, and I need to be able to come home. I need to be able to work uninterrupted in the morning, you know, take care of CycleSmart business, answer emails, and then just go smash training, come home, eat, and then get back in front of the computer until midnight every night. And so just having a place to myself allows me to really, really focus. You know, it's obviously tough being away from home. I'm leaving my 2.5-month-old baby and my wife at home, and that is probably the most difficult thing I've done so far as a bike racer. And I'm glad that this is the last time I'm ever going to have to do that. I almost didn't come for that reason. And, you know, Janice really encouraged me to follow through and finish things off. And, you know, she'd hold down the fort, and it's only a 10-day trip. And, you know, but when you have a 2.5-month-old, you know,
every day
is a new day, right?
Absolutely.
So, yeah. So I'm getting lots of pictures and FaceTime and videos throughout the day, and it's amazing how connected you can stay.
Yeah, that is a huge change. Even, I mean, my oldest is 11 years old, and, like, you know, back a decade ago, none of that was available.
Right. And, you know, it's not a substitute for holding the baby in your arms, or just being able to help out Janice. You know, she's breastfeeding, so she's attached to the baby pretty much 90% of her waking hours are connected to the baby. So just to be able to help her out, you know, I want to hold the baby as much as I can, but even just to be there so that she can take a shower or go to sleep for a little while, you know, she's doing great, and I wouldn't be able to do all this without Janice's help. So, but I'm anxious to hold the baby, and they're coming down to Asheville. So I'm going to fly home for Christmas, and then we're all going to come back down together, and they'll be there for the week with me in Asheville. And that will be a family trip, which is what bike racing will look like for me in the future. It'll either be a family trip or, you know, I won't do it, basically.
Yeah. No, I think that'll be fun.
Yeah, but the training's going well, I guess, to answer your question. So, you know, I really was focused on the second half of the season, and that's part of why it was important to come down and follow through with this camp. You know, I don't have any big goals for nationals other than to go as fast as I can. But I didn't want to show up, you know, half-assed and just ride around and embarrass myself. And even if I decided to do the 40-plus race, I knew that if I did that, I was coming to win. I needed to be prepared to win. I couldn't just ride around in that race, because that really, I think that would have been depressing for me. It wouldn't have been that enjoyable. So
you're doing the elite race. Are you doing any other races? Are you going to do the single speed or any?
I'm not. I'm just going to do the elite race. The single speed race is on Friday, and I just really want to have the best elite race I can. I don't want to compromise that in any way. And Friday is just a terrible day to add a second race. I think if it was Saturday, I would probably do it, because I would use it as my opening up workout for the elite race. And if it was on Wednesday, like it used to be, I would do it because it's that's the day I'm doing a workout anyway. And that's how I stumbled into that race in the first place, and then discovered how much I liked it and what a good time it was, and just how mentally engaged I had to be for that race. I liked it a lot. But it's not my priority, and I'll leave it to the guys who are going to take that race, you know, seriously enough to do it Friday. And I'm going to stay focused on the elite race. And my training's going great. Everything's happening on the script that I wrote. You know, once I saw what my challenges were for this season and made some predictions about when I would be good and when I wouldn't and when I could train and when I couldn't, and things are really on schedule. It's actually kind of nice.
That's great. So we're jumping in here at the end, at the culmination. And I think a lot of people that may be listening to this, especially some just getting into cyclocross, may not know who Adam Myerson is. I mean, I think a lot of us look at you as one of the most well-known characters in U.S. cyclocross, but many may not know your background. So can we just sort of like go to the beginning when you got into cycling? What got you to where you are now?
Sure. Well, and I'll try to be as brief as I possibly can.
I know that could be another couple hours, but yeah.
I know. I grew up in Brockton, Massachusetts, about 20 miles south of Boston. It's kind of a rough place, and it's a miracle that I found cycling, or that cycling found me, and I fell in with a group of guys that local bike shop that were also just getting into cycling around the same time and starting to race, and they were all 10 years older than me, and you know, those guys were all kind of my big brothers, and did my first group rides with those guys, and I don't know, I just I liked it. I had a knack for it. I improved pretty quickly and got plugged into Mass Bay Road Club, which is a very popular club at the time in southeastern Massachusetts. And it's a club that Mark and Frank McCormick and Bill Sykes were involved in, and Tom Stevens and Paul Curley and all the legends of, you know, New England cycling and cyclocross generally. I just lucked into that club and that culture, and cyclocross was simply something that you did. It was part of the culture of the club. And so the first year I raced, I didn't race cross at all, and I missed nationals when it was in Plymouth that year. That was the first year I had raced, but I hadn't heard of cyclocross.
So what year is that?
87.
Okay.
Yeah. Or 87 or 88. I think it was 88 that nationals was in Plymouth, because 89 was the first year I raced cross, 89 and 90. My last 2 years as a junior were 89 and 90. So yeah, maybe nationals was in 88 in Plymouth. But I could be off by a year.
Sure, 87, 88. Late 80s, early 90s, right in that area.
Yeah. And like Mark McCormick won junior race at his own high school. The race was at Plymouth High School, and that's where he was a student, and he won the junior races. I mean, you can only imagine what that would be like. But so that was the culture I came into. And so, yeah, my first year senior was 1991. And, you know, I on the road, I was winning Pro and 2 races when I was still a junior. So I, you know, again, like had showed some promise and just bounced around the sport for the 90s, you know, trying to get a semester of college done every year and trying to get a pro contract and riding for good amateur teams and just banging my head against the wall. And in an era where I didn't quite understand what that wall was made of, I guess you could say.
Sure.
There were a lot of challenges out there that I just was a little naive about, maybe, and I was trying to do things a certain way. And I think I had a lot of challenges outside of doping, you know, as well, financial. I had lots of limiters that I was always sort of pushing back against. Financial was probably as big a limiter for me as other people's doping was, you know, in that window. But we learned how to live off prize money and sleep in the car, and you know, honestly, like, It was a good time. I have a lot of fond memories, and I made some of my best friends in that period. But I always raced cyclocross as well, and loved cyclocross, and would have been a full-time cyclocrosser even back then, if that was something that was available. You know, we didn't have an under 23 category back then, and I go back and look at my results from when I was in that age group, and I was always the first under 23. You know, I would have been in a program, the program that exists now. To scoop riders like me up didn't exist then, and I just got lost at sea. Sometimes is what it feels like. So, I did that until I was 26. The year that I was 26 was my last year taking it seriously. I was going to be 27 the next year. I had won collegiate cross nationals. I'd gotten married. My college loans were all going to start needing to be repaid since I was graduating. And I was like, well, I'm going to be 27 and I haven't made it. And I think this is as far as I'm going to go. It's time for me to get serious and get a job. Because back then, if you weren't a pro by the time you were 26 in the 90s, you know, we were still looking at the era before, you know, in terms of when people retired and when their careers happened. And people retired in their early 30s back then. So to be turning 27 and not having turned pro, it was time to get a job. So I did. And I kind of retired from pursuing professional racing, retired from, you know, obviously wasn't a pro back then, but I would refer to myself as a full-time cyclist because I was living off bike racing, but I was doing that as an amateur, as a journeyman, basically. I spent 4 years just racing for fun. I started coaching, quit the clothing sales job that I had, and, you know, I started coaching as a volunteer for fun just to help out some juniors, and it turned into a business very quickly where I had more clients that I can handle and needed to bring in some other friends who were also Cat Ones who needed to pad their income, you know, maybe had exercise science degrees. And this is sort of the birth of the coaching industry. There weren't other coaching companies, didn't quite exist yet.
Right. You know, so what year is this when Cycle Smart really got off the ground?
It would have been 98. I incorporated in 99 and I think I hired my first coach in 99 or 2000. So we got started more or less the same time that Carmichael and Friel got started. You know, we just caught that early wave of people deciding that coaching was something worth paying for. Because previously you learned all these things through your local cycling club,
right?
You know, through some crusty old group guru on the group ride. And I was lucky to have guys like, you know, Bill Sykes and Paul Curley, you know, as my first coaches. We definitely came through the club, but Paul Curley was someone that I paid to coach me. You know, so I had, even when I was just struggling to cover my expenses racing bikes, I still paid Paul Curley to help me get better. And I learned so much from those guys. So when I started coaching, it was really just a way to sort of pay back all the people who had helped me. I thought, you know, I'll coach this junior team and help myself feel better about all the years I spent trying to become a bike racer. Everything that I've learned, I don't want to just stop here. You know, maybe I can help some kids go a little further than I did. And then it turned into a job, and then it turned into a business. And I figured that's what I was going to be doing. I wasn't trying to race full time. And so 2003, the year that I would have turned 31, I got an offer to turn pro sort of out of the blue. I had started doing well as an amateur, just racing for fun, and just kind of had kind of gotten back to or even surpassed the level that I had been at when I was really trying to race full time. I think, you know, mostly as a result of finally having a little bit of financial security and knowing a lot more about training and racing. And as I became a more successful coach, I was able to coach myself better as well. And so I turned pro in 2003 thinking, oh yeah, you know, I can kind of like back off the business just a little bit. You know, it'll be good for the business if I'm out there racing, probably do this for a season, you know, get the monkey off my back and then go back to just coaching full time. And that turned into a 13-year professional career that I, you know, could never have anticipated was going to finally happen for me at that late a time. But once I was in and I, you know, once I got some at-bats, you know, I was able to show everybody that I was a solid player and worth hiring back every year.
And it seemed like, yeah, and it's amazing. I didn't really know that part of the story that you were had pretty much retired for the first time at 27. And when you came back, it seems like your strength was in your power and, you know, in the crit circuit. And that's really where you were the most valuable. Is that right? Or did you feel like you're more all around racer at that time?
No, for sure. My focus was on the criteriums when I came back. But at the same time, I think at first, the goal was to be well-rounded. Like, I was going to stage races. You know, I did Redlands. I did San Dimas. I did Sea Otter. And for sure, I was a sprinter. And for sure, I was good at criteriums because that's how you made money if you lived on the East Coast in the 90s. There's just if you don't have a salary and you can sprint, you don't spend all your money going to a race like Redlands that has minimal prize money in comparison to, and a lot of expenses in comparison to, say, the Tour of Somerville, which, you know, is $150 entry fee with a $10,000 prize list.
Right.
It's just economically not how you do it. And that's why sometimes the guys with a little more financial support were able to go further, because they could make investments in their careers where I had to get immediate return on my talent in order to get to the next race. So that's essentially, you know, and I was a field sprinter, so I focused on criteriums. But, you know, really, like, one of my first big wins was a national racing calendar road race in Ocala, Florida. You know, granted, it was only 80 miles and mostly flat. It was in the quote-unquote hilly part of Florida, so it wasn't dead flat, but there's certainly no climbing. But, yeah, I won the field sprint there and was leading the NRC for a week or so until it was the first race of the year, so, you know, until Redlands was over. You know, and I was 24 when I did that. I think I won the GS Mangione Grand Prix when I was 22, you know, which was a really, really big race back then. And so I had a lot of results. I won stages of the Tour of Michigan, you know, all in my early 20s when I was an under 23. You know, I was winning pro level, national level, pro 1-2 races. And that should have turned into a contract for me, and it never did.
Yeah.
So when I came back, even though I had not become a pro, I did have a reputation for being knowledgeable and savvy at that point. And so my role, even on, like, that first year on Sportsbook, you know, it was a team of neo pros. Every guy in that team was a brand new pro, but I was hired as the captain. You know, I was sort of the king of the dweebs in a sense, you know, like, we were all neo pros and I was the captain of the neo pros. So, but I did well that year. That was the year I won the last stage of the Tour of Ireland, and I had good enough results. So, I mean, that's an example. Like, you know, I survived a national tour and then won the last stage of a national tour in Dublin, in Phoenix Park in Dublin.
Yeah. Was that the milk race?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So to survive the milk race, you know, it shows you I was never just a criterium rider, but the opportunities that were presented to me and the best way for me to make a living ultimately ended up being to focus on criteriums. They're very tactical. They suit my physical abilities. But I do have a lot of depth as a rider. I'm good at long races. I've always enjoyed Philly and done well at Philly. I like to train, I like to ride all day, I have good endurance. I'm not much of a climber. And a lot of times, if you want to be good at stage races and road races, you've also got to be able to go up hills. And that was my main limiter in terms of expanding what I do into stage races or hillier one-day races.
And you were, what's always amazing is that you, throughout this whole career, you've been able to, you know, we all think of you as this cyclocross guy, but it doesn't seem like you ever really put one ahead of the other. I mean, you were always focused on whatever season it was. And I'm sure that along with a coaching company on top of it, you basically had three separate jobs.
Absolutely. And I would add, like, being married to that was also one of my jobs, you know? So a person who's been very helpful to me throughout my career was the director sportif on my second year. I have a lot of people who've made a difference in my life for sure. Bill Laudin was my director the first year on Sportsbook and is one of my best friends still today. The second year when I was on Mathis Brothers, Sharper Image, one of the owners and directors of the team was a guy named Chris Duroy. Chris is still one of my closest friends now, and he would always remind me that, you know, you can do two things. You can't do three. Once you add that third thing, everything suffers. And I was always doing three things.
Right.
I was married to my first wife. I was trying to run a business, and I was trying to be a pro bike racer. And so you could say that I didn't do any of those things to the limit of my potential or to the most success, because I just always have been going from one thing to the next. I think within a single season, though, you're absolutely right. I did not prioritize one over the other in terms of cyclocross versus road. I mean, there was 1 year I spent the winter racing in Switzerland. I came home for one weekend and then left the next week with the road team to go to Texas. You know, I stayed in Switzerland through the World Championships.
For cyclocross.
Yeah. And that year I was the first alternate. I didn't make the team. It's just kind of funny. Like, so it's typical of my career. Every year they don't fill. In the 90s, they would never fill all the spots for Worlds. In order to go, if you weren't like Mark Gullickson or Todd Wells or something like that, if you wanted to go, you just basically had to be good enough to finish on the lead lap and make the commitment to continue to race after Nationals in December. You know, Nationals would end. And that's part of why it was possible to do road and cross back then. If cross season ends the first week of December, well, then you have, or second week of December, you can take Christmas and New Year's off and then go somewhere warm January 1 and have 2 or 3 months to train to get ready for the road season. It was entirely possible to do both. That's not the case anymore. And I think that has shown in my results over the past couple of years. And it's shown in people finally being forced to choose one or the other. You know, people like Jeremy, who used to be able to do both. You know, if Nationals is in January and if you're trying to go to Worlds, your season's not over until, you know, the last week of January. That is, and then if you want to take a break after that, you know, you're not getting back on the bike until late February, maybe even March 1st. If you're getting back on the bike March 1st, you've already missed Tour of California, you know, in some cases, you know, depending on the year. Or like if you want to be, it's very hard to do both.
Right. So going back to the starting of the coaching business, from when you started that until what you're looking at now, how has that changed, not only from your own business, but just the way that coaching is done? I mean, I'm sure the internet had a huge impact on that. You were coming in right at the beginning of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I was one of the first pros in the U.S. to race with a power meter. No one had really done that in the U.S. You know, like, the very first Philly that I did in 2003, I raced that with a power meter. A lot of people were starting to train with power meters, but no one would race with one because they were heavy. But I realized right away that collecting data for everything I did was crucial. And if I wanted to understand how to create workouts, I had to know what the races actually looked like. And you had to collect data for the races. So just collecting data from Philly, which I finished my first Philly in 2003, man, that was huge to have that file. And at that time, I had bought my power meter from Paul Kirkley in Switzerland, who had been Greg LeMond's coach and who had devised this really powerful software to analyze the data files. So I was learning an immense amount from him. So definitely we were on the front line of power training, but even before that, obviously, we're just collecting heart rate data from people and thinking about perceived exertion. And it's funny how things have come full circle. You know, I obviously was coaching before most people had power meters. Something like Training Peaks didn't exist. You know, getting data files from people's polar heart rate monitor was, you know, people were keeping handwritten logs, mm-hmm. and they were dumping like total minutes spent in a zone into a training log. And that was the best we could do for data collection. So, you know, it's something like Training Peaks coming along, or WKO, you know, everybody having a power meter. What's really great is I can just do so much more for an athlete when I can collect data from them and analyze that data and have these powerful tools for data analysis. None of that replaces a coach's, let's call it, intuition or like instinct, or if you want to be more specific, like ability to do analytic reasoning, but also to be a good therapist. You know, you have to be able to hear fatigue in an athlete's voice. You have to be able to find out what's going on in their personal lives. You really have to be a good therapist to be a good coach. And so I think new coaches have it, let's say, easy in a way, because they have all these tools available for them that help them get started. You could say the same thing for people who are becoming bike fitters. You know, when I first learned how to do bike fitting, I had a tape measure and a plumb bob. And, you know, you relied on your own eyes, and I still rely on my own eyes. You know, it, same thing with data files. You know, the data tells me something, but so does the sound of an athlete's voice. And I think being able to that's what a coach is. You know, I'm not an exercise scientist, but I'm also not, you know, a coach who just is going on his own experience. And, you know, the athletes don't just do a percentage of the workouts that I do. You know, everybody doesn't get the same program. But being in the middle between those things is someone who can read exercise science and understand and digest exercise science and can learn from the exercise scientist, and then combine that with personal experience, being able to tell somebody when to coast and when to break in a corner, when to stick their wheel in the rut and when to ride the grass around the edge. That's I think why we're, if we're successful at CycleSmart, it's because I've got a team of coaches who all coach in that style.
Right.
And I think that's the people, that's how we draw people in.
I think that's important, because you can, and this is what I see, just my own take on coaching, is that after a while, everybody can learn how to train. It's more learning how to race that I think that, is you can get from some coaching and not from others. So I think that definitely is a distinction out there from what I see as the better coaching outfits out there, as opposed to just learning how to get fit.
Yeah. Well, or learning when not to train, learning when to not do the last interval that was assigned to you. And not to feel guilty about it, not to let your ego rule your training. This is where the therapy aspect is so crucial. But yeah, for sure, I think, like, we do so much with our athletes at cross camp, where we can come and see them in person. You know, when I'm in a cyclocross race, I gather up all the CycleSmart athletes that, you know, whether they're my clients or not, as long as they're clients of someone within the company, and I try to pre-ride with them. It's sort of a bonus thing that they get from being clients, no matter what level client they are. If I'm there and I'm warming up, it's almost like there's a mini bonus clinic for them where we're pre-riding the course together. And I know lots of people have seen that. They've watched me do it. They see the crowd of us riding around on the courses together. But that's the benefit of being part of our group, I think, is, you know, you get course analysis from being at the same race as your coach, whether it's your coach or, you know, CycleSmart is definitely a collective. We are aware of each other's clients. We have weekly meetings as coaches where we discuss what we're doing with our clients. We raise each other's level. It's sort of like we have our own built-in continuing education program. We are not isolated from each other as coaches. We're definitely very connected. We prepare reports for each other on our clients. You know, every month, each coach gets to see what the other coach's clients are up to. And so we learn from that.
So going along those same lines, here's actually one of the questions that I jotted down, because I know it's something that we've talked about just, you know, through social media or sometimes in person. But so I'll just put this sort of broad question out there to you. Why is technique important in cyclocross?
I think technique is important in all disciplines of cycling. And it's part of why I think I've done so well both at cyclocross and criteriums, is because they're so technique oriented. And one of my strengths happens to be agility. And so by having good agility, I'm able to use less power. And since I don't make a lot of power, at least not at threshold, I need every energy saving trick I can utilize in order to make my limited threshold power production go further. So technique ends up being important because you go faster with less energy. If you can go faster with less energy, then the moments where you really need to dig in, that energy is available to you, that power is available to you. And, you know, technique isn't just about mounting and dismounting. Technique is about turning. It's about pedaling efficiently over bumpy ground. It's about knowing when to pedal less and when to go all in and pedal as hard as you can to, like, clear a section quickly, even though it costs you a little bit of extra energy to do it, because the net lap time will increase because you smash a particular section and then recover after, as opposed to riding the whole thing at one steady effort. So it's part of what makes cyclocross interesting. It's a leveler. You know, you can't just, you've seen plenty of guys who come in with huge watts per kilogram into cyclocross and they're just bringing their Wapazooka all over the course and getting nothing out of it, you know, just blowing every turn and going too fast into turns, you know, not getting on the gas soon enough out of them, just wasting energy everywhere.
Yeah, and then at the highest level, you can see guys who, and I know you've pointed this out at times, may not have the best technique, that I think your point is always look how much faster they could be, even though they're world-class athletes now.
Yeah, it's funny. I think sometimes people get offended when I'm talking that way, and I think part of it is just because it's Twitter. Like, they somehow think that I think I'm superior, which of course I don't, but I do like to consider myself an expert in this field, and just because someone has reached the top of the sport doesn't mean they've maximized all of their potential. And, you know, I study the races, I study the athletes. You know, I don't just watch the races as a fan, although I definitely do. You know, I watch the races as an analyst.
So as an, I'm going to, you know, because I think one of the people that gets called out a lot is Lars Vanderhaar for technique, and also just how he looks on a bike. To me, and I don't know how closely you've been watching him in races, because he's, you know, sort of been here and there, but to me, especially like in a race like Valkenburg this year, it looks like technique-wise, and even just maybe even fit-wise, I mean, how he looks on a bike, it looks like there's been a change since last year for the better.
Well, I know that if something changed about his bike, and I don't know the details of it, but I agree with you, and I think, so Vanderhaar is obviously someone with a lot of agility. He's very explosive. He's a small, explosive guy. You know, if you were to compare him to someone on the road, he's a Paolo Bettini guy. You know, he's a very small sprinter. You know, when he has a background in gymnastics, I believe, and yeah, it makes a lot of sense when you see how his body moves. And my complaints about his technique are one, yeah, I think his bars are entirely too high. And because his bars are so high, he keeps his elbows bent and his forearms straight, which means he has basically no weight on his hands. And when he has no weight on his hands, it means he has no weight on his front tire. And when you have no weight on your front tire, you lose your front tire in turns all the time. Lo and behold, one of Lars's problems is he loses his front tire in turns constantly.
Right. Those steep off cambers when he's making those tight turns, he's always washing out that front tire, it seems like.
Exactly. And in my opinion, if his bars were a centimeter lower and there was more weight on his hands, you know, if his body position didn't change at all, but that his hands were lower so that more of the weight of his chest was in his hands and on his hoods, he'd be sticking that front tire into the dirt. And I think he would fall less. Now, I've never had this conversation with him. I don't know his logic behind his fit. It could be because if he tries to ride a smaller bike to get his bars lower, the bike doesn't fit. You know, he can't carry the bike. And I just, you know, I'm sure someone's had this conversation with him. I don't know what the answer is, but I do know that his bars are too high, yeah, for whatever the reason. And then, you know, and I think he rides a more aggressive tread than most people in the same races. You know, if everybody's on a middle tread, he's on a mud tire. If everybody's on a file tread, he's on a middle tread. And this is part of the problem. So he could ride faster treads if he could stick his front tire into the dirt better than he does. And then, of course, I'm always complaining about his remount. And, you know, the problem with his remount is they all learned it from Groenendaal, who, you know, I raced against Richard Groenendaal when I was in Europe. You know, when I was coming up and finally watching these races on TV, you know, Groenendaal was the best Dutch rider. Groenendaal does that spring, you know, he does the Superman type remount, and Groenendaal is essentially the best guy of the generation before the current generation, and so that's where Vanderhaar learned his technique from, and so it's just habit for him. But you can just simply watch where everybody gets on their bike and most people continue with their right foot forward onto the pedal as part of the remounting process. And Vanderhaar's got his feet behind him when he, you know, he jumps up and lands on his bike with his feet behind him. And as everybody's pedaling away, he's still moving his feet forward onto his pedals. Now you can say, oh, well, he still wins. It's obviously not hurting him. I just think that's ridiculous. He doesn't win every race. And when he does win, he could perhaps win by more. In any case, he's giving a second or a half a second away every single time he gets back on his bike. I think if you're racing at the highest level in the world and you're not trying to address weaknesses like that in your technique, then I guess I'm just confused. Why hasn't someone had this conversation with him?
Sure. Do you think that the weight of bikes today has contributed to sloppier technique?
I do think that, yeah. I could never have imagined holding my bike by the hood and swinging it around
the
turn.
That's exactly what I'm thinking about, yeah.
Yeah, 10 years ago. Like, and so when I see it now, it looks crazy to me because it's like unthinkable. But then I realize, like, oh, his bike weighs 15 pounds. Like, it's not actually a big deal to swing it around like that. And in some cases, it ends up being faster, even though it, you know, it burns your eyes to see.
Yeah, it looks awful and it looks like they're out of control, but it's almost, you're almost possibly looking at like the evolution of technique, which just seems crazy. But if it's something that, you know, is successful, and I don't know if it's slowing them down.
Right. And I think, you know, every now and then you'll see someone try and reinvent cyclocross technique. They'll come at it fresh and think, oh, well, it's more comfortable for me to do it this way. They'll do something like step over their top tube instead of around the back of their bike. And they're like, oh, well, this is faster for me. And it's one of those things where you're like, ugh, we've been racing cross for 100 years, man. Like, you're not gonna, we've already solved all these problems. There's a reason these styles are accepted and standard. But then every now and then something happens that changes technique. Clipless pedals, for instance, changed technique. You know, I'm not exactly sure that disc brakes have changed technique, but it has certainly encouraged people to lock their rear tire up more and slide around turns, change their direction. And that's not something you could do with a 20-pound bike and Mayfac canties. Like, that just didn't happen. You know, obviously, you can do that now with carbon wheels and, you know, a TRP Revox brake. Locking your wheel up with canties is certainly no problem. And I do it, and I didn't. That's a change in my own technique. So, sure, and so now light bikes.
Yeah. And that's the disc brake thing that's why when he's, you know, on his game, that Matthew Vanderpoel is so fun to watch, because he can pull off all those. I mean, he can squeeze himself into a line of riders by just, you know, shredding a turn and drifting into them with those disc brakes. But at the same time, it bites him sometimes too, because it's not, you don't have total control over it.
Sure. Well, you know, he's also 20. Yeah. And so I think that's part of why you got to remember, like, I'm sure you know some 20-year-olds, you know, he acts like a 20-year-old sometimes in the races. And thank God for that, because it's amazing to watch.
Oh, yeah. And it's a great foil between him and Van Aert, who acts like a 30-year-old.
And I'm glad that you pointed out, because I really think that is the difference between them. Like, Van Aert doesn't necessarily, he's not the one who makes that early attack that splits the group. It's always Vanderpoel, and Van Aert has to go after him and can. But you notice when Vanderpoel wasn't there, Van Aert was perfectly happy to ride with Nice and race him on the last lap, kind of conserve his energy, be a little more conservative. You know, I think Van Aert also has a different position on the bike. It almost looks like a road position, and I think that's part of why, you know, he doesn't bunny hop things. When your bars are that low, you definitely cannot hop barriers, because you'd be going over the bars when you do it. But Vanderpoel sits a little further forward. His bars are a little higher. He can be a little bit more acrobatic in that sense. But those guys both just, they throw themselves at things and deal with it when they get there, rely on their skill to get themselves out of those problems. I think watching Coxide and watching Van Aert at Coxide was really incredible, because the way he put himself into those ruts, you know, in a sandy race like that, if you line the rut up correctly, you're almost not pedaling. There's no resistance. You're just in the track, and you hit that line, and it doesn't require a lot of power to go fast. If you blow the line, if you leave the rut, then it's, you know, you're 500 watts plus just to keep moving. So the difference between being perfect and making a mistake is the difference between going really, really fast and running, you know, and standing still.
Yeah, and in that race specifically, because that was, you know, from lap to lap, it was inches, and all the top guys, if they missed it, you know, they were expending that energy.
Yeah, they'd lose 5 seconds on a single mistake, but fortunately, everybody was losing 5 seconds on a mistake all day long, and it was just what was the net, you know, at the end of the race? How many times did you screw up? How many times did you get it right?
other than I guess since, let's just stick with the European scene, other than just those young guys, what has excited you and what maybe has disappointed you just with the pro? I don't know. I almost look at it as a different sport at this point, but just as European cyclocross, as it's evolved, I guess, over the last decade.
What do I think has been good and what do I think has been bad
yeah.
in that growth? Well, so like I was put on the UCI Cyclocross Commission in that first or early years of the UCI's cross reform program.
You know, right. And that specific. let's just back up there, because can you
we didn't really finish, did we?
No, but but I think that's an important, an important milestone to point out is how you got that position, you know, first and only American for years to be on there, and what that meant and what you were able to see and contribute to from that position.
Right. So like we talked about my career as a racer, but I had a parallel career as a race organizer. Always, you know, again, like always got some project going. So I put on my first cross race when I was 19. I was a student at UMass. It's a collegiate, you know, project. And put on what is, you know, still the race that I put on now today. That's now the Northampton International. You know, it started off as a UMass cyclocross in 1991. And I don't know. I'm just not really a quitter, I guess. Once I started doing it, I just kept doing it and kept trying to make it bigger, and eventually became a UCI event in 2000, and just stubborn enough to keep doing it every year. And the thing that got me the position nominated cross commission is, you know, USA Cycling was not very involved in promoting cyclocross at the time. We were growing it ourselves. We weren't getting any money from them. We weren't getting any attention from them. So it was the Wild West, and we just organized ourselves. And there, when I first came up in the sport in the late 80s and early 90s, there was a lot of rivalry between the regions. And cross was very parochial. You raced in your own region, and there was no national series. And the only time you saw other riders from other regions was at nationals. And so cross in Seattle looked very different from cross in New England, which looked very different from cross in Colorado. You know, and they were really very dependent on usually like one single person who influenced the scene. You know, San Francisco had Lawrence Malone and, you know, Tim Rutledge in the Northwest. We had Paul Curley and Tom Stevens in the Northeast. And so some of these guys had gone to Europe and come back. Some of the guys had gone to England and come back and were really influenced by British cross. British cross had a big influence on American cross, you know, as much as European cross did. We were lucky that we had Paul Curley, who had spent 6 years or so, you know, racing cross in Switzerland, spoke perfect Swiss German, had done all the big races, and taught us so much about international cross and how the courses should be set up. So you get to nationals and everybody fights about what cross is in that period, because we're all just doing some slightly different variation about what we think cyclocross is.
Right. So you'd have, you know, just for instance, which is something people, especially in the East Coast, may have never seen, multiple barriers in a row.
Well, we did have that stuff even in the Northeast back then. Sure.
Well, like I'm saying today.
Exactly. Yeah. There's a standard now. And I guess the question is, like, how did that standard come about? Why is there an American standard for course design? And how did this information get out there? Well, it got out there because I figured out how to put UCI races on and follow those standards. And we had already raised the level in New England, and then UCI races were a way to, for us to all follow the same standard no matter where we were. But in the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic, we were one of the first ones to figure out how to put on UCI races and get access to that information. And so rather than compete with those other regions, I was very interested in growing the sport nationally and creating a professional cyclocross circuit in the U.S. And so I shared my resources with other organizers who were interested. I started an organizers meeting at Nationals. I started what I called the USAICO, the U.S. Association of International Cyclocross Organizers. And it was basically an extension of the European organization, the AIOC, the International Association of Cyclocross Organizers. I created an American branch of that. And And the other regional organizers responded. They were interested. They wanted to share info. And so I just headed that effort up as a volunteer because, you know, again, like USA Cycling was ignoring us. And I told everybody everything that I knew. And I went to the international meetings. You know, I'd go to Worlds every year and I would go to the international meetings and I'd bring that information back and say, guys, this is what they're saying in Europe. This is what people are doing. Here's what they want from us. And so as a result of that, I got named to the management committee of the International Association of Cyclocross Organizers, which is a private association. It's not affiliated directly with the UCI, although the president of the AIOC sits on the UCI board usually. But at that time, Gerard Biseglia was the president of USA Cycling. He was very membership-oriented. He really wanted to change cycling in almost all of the same ways that Derek Bouchard Hall is trying to change cycling now. Gerard had the unfortunate circumstance of going up against Steve Johnson and being president of USA Cycling during the Lance years, and they were not as interested in sort of doing the right thing as Gerard was. But Gerard identified me, I guess, understood like that I was trying to do things a certain way, and the Cross Commission, as part of their reform, you know, they knew there was a lot of growth in the U.S. and they wanted to expand Cross in the U.S. and they wanted an American on the commission. And so Gerard asked me if I wanted the job. It was a 4-year term, and I a couple times a year I'd get flown to Belgium, and Erwin Verbeken would pick me up at the airport, and I'd go to a hotel in Brussels and fake it in French for a couple hours and basically participate in the rulemaking process for the sport globally. I did that for 4 years.
What's your biggest take? I mean, do you come out of that energized after that 4 years? Do you come out jaded from the process? I mean, what's your takeaway from that time?
A little bit of both. Yeah. So anyone who's been to Europe understands that things do not move quickly in Europe. You know, I never thought of myself as particularly American until I went to Europe for the first time and realized that no matter how radical I thought I was, that part of my radicalism also included a very American entrepreneurial spirit. And that spirit exists in punk as well. Like, anything's possible. You just do it yourself. You just make things happen. And that is not how things work in Europe. And it's why entrepreneurially minded Europeans come to the U.S. It's you think we have restrictions here, you know, try and get anything done in Europe. The most common refrain you get from people is it's not possible, you know, especially if it's 4:45. If it's 4:45, then nothing is possible. So things did move slow over there. Peter van den Abele, who's the head of the commission now, he is great. And he pushed back as hard as he could against his bosses to get change done. Change would have happened more quickly, particularly change for the women, if Peter could have moved things along at the speed that he would have liked to. I really liked working with and for Peter, and I couldn't say enough good things about him. He really believes in women's cycling, and you see that now with the progress. Like, on my term on the commission, one of the things that I pushed through was that every C1 was obligated to have a women's race as well. And that was revolutionary at the time, because none of the big races in Europe had women's races at all. And that's why American cyclocross, women's cyclocross, has always been strong. Like, the success that we're having now is really only on par with the success that we were having in the 90s, because our cross scene, and in the early 2000s, our cross scene has always focused on the women. And in Europe, they didn't even have races to do. There was no reason for the American women to go race in Europe. It was better here.
Right.
So that rule change was really focused on improving things for women in Europe. And it's probably the thing that I'm most proud of in terms of things that I accomplished while I was on the commission there. And, you know, we tried to increase prize money, just get women's racing to be taken more seriously. And they've obviously continue to make progress, but you can see how slow it's been. With the AIOC, I eventually did quit because I just felt like it was the meetings were, you'd go to these meetings and they would just talk about the next meeting. It was the worst example of European bureaucracy that it was just a cliche. And I was like, this group gets nothing done. They just meet, and in the meetings, they talk about the last meeting and they talk about the next meeting and we talk about the finances, and they just weren't using email effectively. it just felt like a social club. And so I quit.
What do you think about the, I don't know if globalization is the right word, the U.S. becoming more part of that European scene? So I guess what I'm getting at, do we want more World Cups here? Do we want a super prestige race here? Do we want that kind of level in the U.S. every year? Is that a positive, or is it better that we have sort of what they do there and then our grassroots races here?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there was a time where I think we were all trying to copy the European success, and I think that is a mistake now, and I don't think anyone here really wants to copy the European model exactly. You know, I think you see that happen on the road with, you know, the medalist races, Tour of California, Colorado. You know, there's this, you know, there's a group of people who think that the only important cycling in the U.S. is European-style road racing, and so that's where you get into the war between crits and road races and what we, where we should be putting our resources. And, you know, I believe in American style bike racing, and I believe that that includes criteriums. I think criteriums are very, very special and match up with American fan interest. And so same thing with cross. Cross is never going to draw 10,000 spectators willing to pay $10 or $20 to get in and see the races. And the thing that people forget is, you know, the sport is popular all over Europe, but the races that we're watching on TV are exclusively in Belgium and exclusively in one very small region of Belgium. It would be like if the Super Prestige and the Soudal Classics and the Bpost Trophy all happened inside Route 128 in Boston. And that's what people need to think about. They shouldn't talk about American cross versus Belgian cross, because in Belgian cross, it's like, let's call it like Massachusetts cross, if you want to talk about
It's
landmass.
Well, I always say it's like it's the best local cross series you'll ever come across
exactly.
In the world.
Right. I try to get people to understand that. Like when I say that the Verge series is a national series, you know, it just all happens in one region. And the point that I'm trying to make there is, yeah, you can call the Super Prestige a national series, but it's really a local series. It's not even a regional series. And there used to be, you know, Vetsecon in Switzerland used to be part of the Super Prestige. They used to leave Belgium, but they don't anymore, because once Belgium got TV coverage for its races, that's when the Swiss races started to die and the money was really in Belgium.
Well, yeah, and you can even see it in, I like to call Sunweb the most successful local team ever.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
They don't want to travel anywhere. They're more than happy just to stay in that little region of Belgium and do all their races there, and they complain anytime they have to leave.
Right. And so, you know, if you want to compare it to like American sports, if you were an equivalent sportsman in the U.S. or sports person, since we definitely talk about women's racing as well, competing nationally in the U.S. is completely different than competing nationally in Europe, because you have to cover a landmass that's, you know, bigger than Europe, never mind a single country in Europe. And so every pro sport, national pro sports in the U.S. has this problem. Travel is part of the expense of the sport. So American road racing suffers from this. If you are a Belgian Division III team, you do not leave Belgium. You don't get on a plane. You very rarely don't sleep in your own bed during the week. If you're a Division III team in the U.S., you get in the van at the start of the season and you get dropped off at home at the end of the season. And you are on tour all year trying to travel from race to race to race. And so much of your expense goes towards travel. So when we have a national series in the U.S., you have to think of it more as a World Cup. It has to be a World Cup type thing where the World Cup goes around Europe. It's not all in one country. And so to chase after that requires a lot more money and a lot more work, human resources, financial resources, to chase those races around. And so this is why I think the Pro CX is useful, even if it has some flaws. We need the Pro CX because the Pro CX is basically the equivalent of the entire European cyclocross calendar, where there's a race in Belgium and a race in Switzerland and a race in Germany all on the same day. No one bats an eye at that. No one in Europe says, oh, we can't have a race in Belgium on the same day there's a race in Italy. That's a conflict. Well, you know what? That's no more a conflict. If that's not a conflict, then it's not a conflict if I have a race in Massachusetts on the same day that there's a race in Washington State. That's also not a conflict.
That's a great point. I've never looked at it like that. That is, yeah, that's great.
People only think it's a conflict because they're all American races, and there's some idea that we have to get all the best American riders at the same race every weekend, but we don't. Those races exist in their region for their region, and we have to develop regional pro riders as well, just like so
are you more in favor of keeping this larger 40 plus race pro CX over trying to recreate a national, like the GP series where you had 8 races?
No, those things aren't mutually exclusive, and I think this is where people get hung up on this.
Okay.
We need both of those things. My focus personally has been putting effort into there being a pro CX, and you can argue that that work that I did before USA Cycling started to get involved was to create this national calendar by helping these promoters in other regions create UCI races, so we had a national circuit of races that eventually became the pro CX, and I stepped down from that role of USA ICO president or organizer when USA Cycling started to step in and get involved and help us out. And I was like, okay, I don't have to volunteer for this anymore. The idea back then was we would shame USA Cycling into helping us. I think what happened instead was we finally had something valuable.
Sure.
And that's when maybe they started to get involved, for better or worse. But people like Bruce Vina had the viewpoint that it was more important that we had a national series. And I just have always believed in both. And I think sometimes Bruce and I would butt heads, because I think sometimes he also thought that I only favored one over the other. And I don't mean to malign Bruce now. I think the work that he did was great. We needed that series. We miss it. He's very, very important to cyclocross. And I wish it would come back, or someone would create something new. But the argument that I couldn't accept was this idea that having a lot of races watered things down. I think having lots of races, the flip side of things being watered down is that you are doing development. You are providing work opportunities to professional riders where they're competing, the level of competition gets higher, the opportunity to earn money goes up, more riders stay in the sport. Like, how many baseball games are there in a Major League Baseball season? What does a team play? 160 games?
Yeah, right.
Are you really telling me that 40 cyclocross races is too much? I don't think so. And I don't think every race has to be the biggest race. That's what a C2 is. A C2 is essentially a regional international race. I know it sounds funny to say regional international, but it's internationally sanctioned, but it's regional in its draw or its scope, because a race in Italy is also a regional race. A race in Switzerland is also a regional race. The difference is Belgium is the NBA. Belgium is the NHL. So where do the best hockey players in the world play hockey? They play hockey in the NHL. So the best cyclocross riders in the world race in these 8-race professional circuits, the Super Prestige, the B Post Trophy. The Sudal Classics aren't officially a series.
Right.
They're a collection of races. They're not a series. And then the World Cup, the World Cup on top of that. And why do we have a World Cup? We have a World Cup because even though cyclocross isn't an Olympic sport, cycling is in that, Olympic sport mindset where World Cups are the way we do our international competitions. So we should not restrict growth of UCI races in America, even when there are conflicts. If there are riders willing to show up and organizers willing to meet the standards, then we shouldn't restrict that. That's how the sport will grow here. When the United States has as many UCI races as all of Europe, that's when we will be on par with Europe. But we do need a national 8-race series that gets the best riders to the best races, either for 4 weekends out of the year, to keep the travel costs low and have double weekends, or, 8 individual C1s spread out throughout the series. But that's not USA Cycling's job. That's a private organizer's job. Belgium does not run a national cyclocross series. Neither should USA Cycling.
No, that makes a lot of sense. And it's I guess it's finding the time to work all of that out with you know, people who do want to go to Europe, and then having that 8-race series in the US, and then having the Pro CX around it. But no, I think I would agree with that both are needed, and hopefully, you know, we can work towards finding someone who's able to organize that and fund it, which is the biggest thing.
Sure. The expertise is out there. You know, like sometimes I could, like, you could be a, there's professional basketball in Germany, in Italy, you know, you if you're not making it in the NBA, you know, you can still play American pro sports, you know, American style pro sports.
Yeah, and I think in cyclocross, you can look at the EKZ series now as a success story in that. This is a series outside of Belgium that has become, in the last 2 years, has just exploded, and they're getting good riders. I mean, look at all the French riders that show up there. Look at the Swiss riders that don't go to Belgium anymore and just stay there and race that. So I think that sort of goes to your point.
Yeah, and for me, that's the second coming of Swiss cross. You know, like when I went to Europe to race cross for the first time, I went to Switzerland. And I went to Switzerland because in the 80s and in early 90s, that's where the best races in the world were. That's where the best riders were. That's where the best start money was. That's where the biggest crowds were. And that's where my connections were. There's lots of New Englanders who went to Switzerland to race cross, you know, courtesy of Paul Curley and the sort of the path that he forged for us. And then it started to die out when, it's funny because some of this is happening now in Belgium, but the top riders started asking for more and more start money. So there was less and less start money available for the mid-pack riders. And then all of a sudden the mid-pack riders stopped getting contracts at all. And so they stopped racing, and then the fields got smaller and smaller. And then the crowds got smaller and smaller. And then the races just died. There was just no budget for those races. So you see, like, this is happening in Europe, with the exception of the crowd decreasing. But you see these European fields, they're getting smaller. The elite races are getting smaller and smaller. They're getting 10,000 euro start money, you know, which, you know, used to be 5,000 euro. So if the start money's gone up, the start money has doubled for the top riders, how many mid-pack or back-marker riders don't get contracts at all and just stop because they can't get a contract. Well, so now only 30 guys start the race.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. And that was the, you know, it's always the shocking thing when you see Belgium, which is supposed to, is the top of the class for cyclocross, and they have, what, 18 guys with contracts in their national championship?
Right. Yeah, exactly. I think there's a lot of riders without contract that you don't realize are technically amateurs, because they're not getting a minimum salary to be considered. You know, to be a pro in Belgium, it's also related to labor laws, not just the UCI contract that you sign. They have other restrictions as well, and so you can sort of like not be on a registered UCI pro team, but the Belgian Federation can consider you a professional because you're getting paid a certain amount, and so it's a labor law thing. And that determines whether you race because you have a contract. It's not about the UCI. It's about Belgian labor. Yeah, I mean, it's funny because the flip side of that is, like, I don't want to say some of the easiest races I did, but the races I was able to get the best results and sometimes have the most success were in World Cups. Because back then you could only have 8 riders per country. And so instead of racing 20 Belgians, I only had to race 8 Belgians.
Right.
And only 50 guys would start, or 55 guys would start, instead of 60 guys. You know, the fields were bigger in Belgium when I was there. And so you had a little bit more space and only 8 Belgians, and, you know, I could get, you know, 49th place and finish on the lead lap, it may sound goofy, but finishing on the lead lap for me in a World Cup, you know, first time I finished on the lead lap in Europe was obviously a huge milestone.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, it was a big success. Yeah.
You know, I was just looking, there was something in one of the Belgian sites today, how Namur is the most, for all 4 fields, the most that have ever entered most riders ever in a World Cup. I think it's like 270 or something, you know, with over 80 for the men and then down from that. Yeah. So it's just like, these fields are getting huge now, especially since, you know, everybody in the top 50 can go.
Yeah. And that was a good, that was a really good rule change. I mean, that, you know, we want the best riders to be there. We don't, it shouldn't, this is why the World Cup is weird, you know, because it's still like run by national federations instead of being a professional sport where the best professionals get to start the biggest races. It was like, why do we care what country they're from? Like, why would we restrict it based on their nationality? Don't you want the best riders there?
Yeah.
This, like, the Europeans still care about country versus country. You know, like, I did a race in Germany, like, specifically marketed as Länderkampf, you know, war between countries. I was like, oh my God, guys. I don't know if this is really the marketing approach that you want to take, but they're still very interested in, you know, like, nationality. Real. I mean, not that it doesn't in the U.S. I mean, go to a hockey game with foreigners, sure, where someone doesn't start chanting USA, USA. But, I mean, don't we kind of lower our heads in embarrassment when that happens?
Yeah. Well, and it's the shock that a lot of these guys come over here when they race and people are cheering for them, that they scratching their head.
Right. You hear that all the time. They're like, people were cheering for me all the way around the course. I didn't understand.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, yeah, well, don't just do the golf clap on the last lap.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Don't want to keep you all evening, so, but there was one thing that I wanted to ask you before we finish up. Just another issue out there that seems to be popping up a lot. Just want to get your thoughts on the $300 pro license and what your feelings are on that increase in the fee for being a pro and racing in the U.S.
Right. So, one, I realize that for people that it's like the percentage increase that's hard for people to swallow. It seems shocking because their license is going up as much as it is. From my standpoint, you know, I know what some of my foreign teammates are paying for their license, and they've always paid a lot more for their license than we have. Sometimes it's included better services. You know, like, I think the Australian license is like $1,000, but it also, I think it might not be that much, but it's some exceptionally high number. But it included really good insurance. You know, they got something for their money. So I guess part of my position is I have so much faith in Derek Bouchard-Hall. It's not blind faith. It's based on something. You know, it's based on my experience with him. It's based on my knowledge of him as a person and his track record since that time as a business person and a successful business person. But, you know, we were friends as bike racers. We were friends as students. You know, we were in college at the same time. I have so much faith in him, and I trust him so completely that if he tells me that the pro license has to go up because the money that we're bringing in currently at the current license price for an international license or a professional license isn't covering what they're spending on professional services for testing and whatever else, then I believe him. And I can accept the fact that it was underpriced previously. But then when I think about the increased doping contribution, it's really not that much money. If you're a Cat 3, it's $5. If you're a Cat 1, it's $25. I can't remember what it is for pro. Is it $50 if you're a pro? Or?
Yeah, I think it's, yeah, yeah.
So I just don't think it's a big expense. And I realize, like, that for some people that's, you know, that's two tanks of gas or whatever. That's something that you're not spending your money on. But, you know, if you're an American professional who can't afford another $150 for your professional licensing, then I think you have other concerns. It's indicative of other problems because you should be able to afford that. Your team should be able to pay it for you, or you should be paying enough. You should be being paid enough to be able to afford your professional fees. Every professional industry has professional fees. It's not unusual. And honestly, like, I'm happy to pay a little extra money for more doping. I already spend a lot of money on it as it is. I've already lost a lot of money in prize money to it. I'm happy to pay $25 more. I think I'll get more than that back in prize money.
All right, Adam. Well, you know, part of me is like, well, you're retiring from racing professionally, and somehow that should be some, you know, should ask you some sort of questions about the end of your career. But honestly, I don't really see it that way because you're not going anywhere. And I hope that, you know, we'll have the opportunity to talk again in the future and have more conversations like this. So I will wish you the best of luck in Nationals, and hope to talk to you again soon.
Yeah, great. You know, thanks for the time, and you're 100% right. That's the best way to put it. I'm not going anywhere. My role will change, but I'll be as involved as ever, and I will definitely see you at Nationals.
And there you have it. That was Adam Meyerson. That was a cool conversation. Hopefully we will get Adam back periodically to get his thoughts on the state of U.S. cyclocross and also things that are going on in Europe. For now, if you want to follow him, he is on Twitter at Adam Meyerson. And thank you all for listening. And we will see you in a week for episode 16 of Crosshairs Radio.